narrations. But as we said, the narrations of Raja'a are widely transmitted, and Raja'a is of the self-evident knowledge of Shi'i sects. And we will also bring you some verses in the Holy Quran that adapt to it. For example, the Holy Quran says, "He is who sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth, that he may prevail it over all religions, though the polytheist may detest." هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون. So there are some other verses of the Holy Quran which do the same as well. But up to now, the religion of Islam has not prevailed over all religions, and the promise of Allah has not been yet done. But it will be, and it will not fail, and this belongs only to the period of Raja. So that's why this verse is also important, since this verse could also be added to the verses that continue the discussion and actually prove the existence of something like Raja. The late Sayyid Murtada Alamul Huda has narrated in his book Muhkam wa Mutashabih from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that this verse relates to Raja in this world. I mean, إن الذي فرض عليك القرآن لرادك إلى معاد. Verily, he who has revealed and ordained the Quran unto you will bring you back to the destination. And the verse continues, قُلْ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ مَنْ جَاءَ بِالْهُدَى وَمَنْ هُوَ فِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. Verily, he who has revealed and ordained the Quran unto you will bring you back to the destination. This part relates specifically to Raja'a, and his knowledge had reached to a point that he knew this verse. And once Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked about the commentary of this verse, and he alayhi salam said, "By Allah, the world will not end till the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam and Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam meet each other in that specific place. And they will build a mosque there, the doors of which will be numerous." That place, that specific place, is mentioned in the traditions, which is a province in the suburbs of Kufa. So, dear listeners, regarding this verse, we said that the beginning part of this verse is specifically related to the concept of Raja'a. And also, the important thing is that the Holy Quran adds that the Holy Prophet must treat very carefully against these actually obstinate opponents. Because the Holy Quran says, قُلْ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ مَنْ جَاءَ بِالْهُدَى وَمَنْ هُوَ فِي الظَّلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. Say, "My Lord knows best him who has brought the guidance and him who is in clear error." So somehow it has been suggested that the way of guidance is clear. And of course, when the way of guidance is clear, the path to aberration is also manifest. So what's the point? The point is that the Almighty Allah is well aware, and the truth-seeking hearts also know this reality. They know how to go for it, they know where to look for it, and they know the exact way to reach it. And that's the, as we said, the manifest commentary of this verse. But as we said, there are some other commentators who have delivered some other probable meanings upon the Quranic word ma'ad. And the purpose of ma'ad, as these commentators believe, is the concept of returning to life after death, the land or the rank of the great intercession, or even paradise, or even Jerusalem. Anyway, up to now we have sufficiently discussed the contents of this 85th verse of Surah Qasas. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio from the heart of Tehran. We're grateful you stay tuned with us throughout the day. First, another compelling segment from our radio productions. We've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Then, for a segment featuring profound scholarship, we bring you Ulema's Speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the Farsi and Arabic voices of well-known and reputable Islamic and Shia scholars and authorities with English translation, a unique opportunity to learn from the masters. To cap off this hour, it's time for Minbar. In this program, we present selected excerpts from the speeches of renowned Islamic scholars, covering a wide range of topics including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and at times social and political issues. Such powerful messages from the scholars. Next up, it's time for another segment of radio productions. Stay with us.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be exposing the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's role in a grotesque plan to turn Gaza into what Donald Trump described as a Riviera of the Middle East. In our first report, Latif Rabachakra sets out some of the sordid detail of Tony Blair's squalid involvement.
News has emerged that the Tony Blair Institute has been involved in planning a post-Palestinian Gaza, which would be marketed as a utopia on the sea. The organization has helped to draw up a map of how the strip would look, including a spot named after Elon Musk and the Trump Riviera. Rather than an abbreviation of his behavior, this is a continuation of his work over decades in war profiteering and directly serving Zionist aims. The Tony Blair Institute has, across the last few years, received at least £200 million from tech billionaire Larry Ellison. Ellison is a very close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu and even offered the Israeli Prime Minister dictatorship of his own data firm, Oracle, which processes the data of many UK government institutions. Ellison is also the largest funder of the Israeli military in history. He's a trusted friend of Elon Musk and lent him $1 billion, with which Musk obtained social media company Twitter. Tony Blair is currently a patron of the JNF with Netanyahu. The JNF is the largest settlement building organization in Palestine, and this was at the same time as being a peace envoy to Palestine. Tony Blair is also a special advisor for global affairs at Israel Lobby Group and Spy Network, the ADL. His wife, Cherie Blair, was also an ethical advisor to the Israeli intelligence firm NSO Group, behind the Pegasus spyware. Blair also has a long history of war profiteering in the Middle East. And after resigning as Prime Minister, Tony Blair was employed as an advisor to the oil company UI Energy. During the same period, UI Energy acquired three Iraqi oil fields. Tony Blair was paid around £1 million a year as an international advisor to an organization called the Mubadala Development Fund in the UAE. It was then reported that Mubadala developed a plan to mine $1 trillion worth of resources in Afghanistan. The Chilcot report also showed that Tony Blair lobbied George Bush on behalf of Siemens for access to power supply contracts in occupied Iraq just 3 months after the illegal invasion. Blair is a mercenary for hire, and he's working for Israel.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the Lobbying Watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. And joining us once again as our guest contributor today is the highly respected and courageous award-winning British investigative journalist, Vanessa Beely. Welcome to the show. David, how would you appraise Tony Blair's post-Downing Street career?
Well, if you listened to the film there, you would have just heard a catalogue of appalling things that he's done even just shortly after the invasion of Iraq. So he's effectively, as the film said, a mercenary, and he's been used as a sort of peace envoy at the same time as he's been making profits for himself and for others. He's been using his think tank to work for all sorts of dodgy clients, including the UAE and the Saudis and of course the Israelis in there as well. So this is a guy who killed 1 million people in Iraq and has subsequently made himself rich off the back of that huge and momentous crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Vanessa, I mean, what do you think motivates Tony Blair these days?
Israel motivates Tony Blair. I mean, if we go back even further in history to the Balkanization of former Yugoslavia, Blair was instrumental in the weaponization of the Takfiri elements against former Yugoslavia. Those same Takfiri elements, of course, were then deployed into Syria and led to the eventual fall of Syria, one of the greatest and most historic supporters of the Palestinian cause. The fall happened in December 2024, and of course, Tony Blair's former chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, we find, was instrumental in the grooming of Jalani as the head of the al-Qaeda government or regime in Syria now, and leading the security war against the resistance axis, including Lebanon and the resistance factions in Iraq.
No, absolutely. Well, David, I mean, what's the significance then, do you think, of the tech billionaire Larry Ellison's relationship with Blair?
Well, look, Ellison's one of the top 10 or 15 richest people in the world, along with a whole bunch of other tech billionaires. And he runs a company called Oracle, which, of course, is effectively at the disposal of Israeli intelligence. He has ex intelligence officers from Israel, very senior in there, and Blair has helped him along the way. Oracle has contracts with the British government to the tune of billions a year, which means that Oracle provides cloud computing services for all of the critical national infrastructure of the UK, the NHS, the National Health Service, of course, but also the Foreign Office, the Home Office, and the Ministry of Defence. So this is effectively a guy who's working for Israeli intelligence, who's very close to Blair as well, and who has managed to get access to what is effectively the critical national infrastructure of the UK, meaning that that the Israelis are able to penetrate all sorts of aspects of British governance and indeed, of course, of the security services and the intelligence services.
I mean, it's an example, isn't it, of sort of state capture, really. I mean, you know, they've got a guy here who's, you know, embroiled in the whole Israeli regime, you know, being responsible for key parts of the British state's infrastructure.
Well, we're talking about one billionaire here, right? And it's already alarming enough just to talk about that a little bit of what this one billionaire is doing. But there are lots of tech billionaires who owe loyalty to the Zionists, whether they're Jewish or not. And this means that the whole of British politics and indeed American politics and of the whole tech world is, of course, captured by Israel in a very real sense. This is not some kind of hyperbole that we want to invent. This is actually how it works. It's not captured by China or Russia or Iran or any other power in the world. It's captured specifically by the Zionists.
And yet there is virtually no, well, I don't think there is any sort of adverse publicity about this, but when there was some talk about, you know, China's involvement with some key infrastructure in the UK, it was a huge, massive issue, wasn't it?
Sure, of course, that's led by the intelligence services, who drip poison into the ears of receptive journalists, and then it becomes a huge issue in the press. Or, you know, the role of the IRGC it's supposed to have in the UK. Yes. All of this is dripped in by the intelligence services, whose priorities are, it appears, being set by the Zionists themselves.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Vanessa, I mean, do you think Blair's role in the so-called peace process then should be a cause for concern? And if you do, and I assume you probably do, you say why?
Well, of course, Blair's involvement in what can only be described as the genocidal project, it's no form of peace process whatsoever, is incredibly nefarious. And at the end of the day, Blair has been working towards this outcome for some time. I mean, everyone points at the first Trump administration as being the originator of the Abraham Accords, which, as David pointed out on X, is the Zionization of the countries that normalize relations with Israel. But in fact, it was Tony Blair that first introduced Yitzhak Molcho in London to a UAE cabinet minister. And in 2016, he engineered the meeting between Mohammed bin Zayed in Saudi Arabia and Netanyahu. So Blair was, if you like, laying the ground for the Trump administration and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, to bring in the Abraham Accords, which, of course, are designed to hand power over to the GCC Zionist bloc in the region and to weaken, if not destroy, the entire resistance axis.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, do you think there's any prospect of this Gaza Riviera plan ever coming to fruition?
Look, we've talked in this program a lot in the last few months about the extent to which the Zionists have been able to have success in their military encounters with the Palestinian resistance, with Hezbollah, with Iran, and of course with Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance. And there are many ways in which when they face direct military face-to-face resistance that they lose. But they have also been very, very successful in some respects. So I think the question, in the end, the question is, it's in the balance. And it's in the balance, and it depends on what people do to resist Zionism, because of course, although they are now back in Gaza, having a really very, very bad time, the Palestinian resistance, the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I mean, having a huge success with their operations in Gaza, it's quite extraordinary. It's not impossible that they will seek to expand their power in a way which we have hitherto not thought possible. That, of course, is what the normalization Zionization process is about. It's about expanding their sphere of influence through the whole of the region, effectively running Saudi Arabia, running the United Arab Emirates, and that's what the project is. So it's not impossible that they will have more success in that area. And it really depends on what the resistance axis is able to do to stop that.
Mm. And talking about the resistance axis, Vanessa, of course, the events in Syria will have undermined the resistance axis, or its ability anyway to resist. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Syria was the main land bridge for the transfer of weapons and assistance from Iran through Iraq and into Lebanon and Palestine. But Syria was also one of the primary manufacturers of the weapons, and particularly the missiles, used by the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance for decades and still being used. And now, of course, the weaponization, the security agreement between Jolani and Netanyahu, which is being strongly denied by the Syrian al-Qaeda regime but appears to be coming to fruition, is to use the Jolani Takfiri elements, particularly the foreign Takfiri elements, the Uyghurs, the Chechens, the Uzbeks, yes. Against Lebanon, they're not going to succeed in a war against Hezbollah, that's for sure. But what they can do is to occupy Hezbollah in fighting them on the eastern border and the northern border, while potentially Israel will invade from the south. And of course, this is all in preparation for the restarting of the aggression against Iran.
Yes.
And this is very clear as a result of the ceasefire that Israel will pivot towards weakening Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance before it replenishes its munition supplies and looks to restart some kind of aggression, whether it's hybrid or direct aggression against Iran.
Yeah. And just before we go to our next report, Vanessa, just say a word or two, will you, about the NSO group where Tony Blair's wife, Cherie, is an ethical advisor.
Well, I mean, you know, the NSO group is the manufacturer, the developer of the Pegasus malicious spyware. And it's no accident that Cherie Blair is involved in what could have potential alongside Oracle and, as David said, all of these other Unit 8200 Zionist intelligence operations that are infiltrating all sectors of Western society and Western governments. But the Pegasus spyware, of course, is being used or has been used in the past to surveil dissident politicians and journalists. And it's clear that this is one of the most potent weapons in the Zionist war box that, of course, has been used against the Palestinian resistance. And we've been saying for a long time that what you've seen being weaponized against the Palestinians is eventually going to come home to roost in the West amongst the governments that have been supporting Israel in committing their genocide since 1917.
Sure, sure. No, indeed. Well, we're going to move to our next report now, which highlights just how deeply entangled with the Israel lobby Tony Blair really is.
Tony Blair is a very well-appreciated figure in Israel, said Israeli former Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, and how right she came to be. It's a little-known fact that Israel lobbyists were also key to Tony Blair's election as the leader of the Labour Party, and then even his election as UK Prime Minister, through his close relationship with Michael Levy, known as Lord Cashpoint. Simultaneous to fundraising for Blair, Levy also worked as a fundraiser for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and had a son, Daniel Levy, working for Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin. Blair was first introduced to Lord Levy by Israeli Embassy Officer Gideon Meir, while Blair was a humble shadow Home Secretary. Levy then set about raising funds for Blair, obtaining them from key Israel lobbyists like Trevor Chan, who funds Starmer and Lamy now, Emmanuel Kay, Labor Friends of Israel, and Chair of Westfield, Frank Lowy, who fought in the ethnic cleansing Haganah during the Nakba of 1948. Israel lobbyist Lord Levy also obtained a £1 million donation to Labour from Formula One boss Bernie Ecclestone, which had to be returned to avoid allegations of cash for favors. When in government, Tony Blair strong-armed Michael Levy into a position of influence at the Foreign Office as an unofficial envoy to the Middle East. Later on, once Prime Minister and knee-deep in service to the Zionist lobby, Blair delivered a speech at the annual Labour Friends of Israel reception in September 2006. "I have never actually found it hard to be a friend of Israel. "I am proud to be a friend of Israel," said Blair, now a long-time reliable asset.
David, I mean, as we've just heard in the report there, I mean, the Israel lobby played a significant role, didn't they, in getting Tony Blair the keys to 10 Downing Street and obviously therefore becoming the Prime Minister. I mean, what do you know about the role that they played?
Well, the fallout between the Labour movement and the Labour Party and the Zionist movement in the period between 1967 and 1993 or 4 or so, when Blair becomes the leader of the party, was quite significant. And pro-Palestinian politics became much more important on the left. And you had in that period, in the 80s and 90s, you had all sorts of actions taken by the left against Zionism. But when Blair comes in, that's when that starts to change, and that's when you start to have the increased importance of Labour Friends of Israel, which of course had been in existence for some years. You have the role, in particular, of Michael Levy, who was introduced to Tony Blair by the Israeli ambassador, and they would then play tennis together, became known as Lord Cashpoint. He was his fixer, and he would get the money in, and then of course he was given this, as we saw in the film there, the role in the Foreign Office. So this is a sea change in the way in which the Labour Party operates. So the Labour Party moved from a kind of social democratic position, sceptical about Israel and Zionism, to a position which was much more in favour of Thatcherite policies, neoliberal policies, but also much more in favour of Zionism. So it's a total change, and that's what we're seeing the after effects of now. And of course, the party became very disillusioned with that, and that's why they elected Jeremy Corbyn in 2015.
Yeah,
so that's the kind of arc of this. And of course, we're now back into a kind of on steroids pro-Israel position in the Labour Party.
Sure, yeah, no, indeed. Well, Vanessa, I mean, how does Tony Blair compare, do you think, to other prime ministers in the extent to which he embraced the Israel lobby?
I think, as David has just described, you know, Tony Blair was instrumental in empowering the Zionist movement in the UK and in UK politics. And, of course, we have to ask the questions with the Trump refusing to release the Epstein files, and now apparently we're told that Epstein killed himself, had committed no crimes, and Glenn Maxwell is in prison for nothing. We know that the Zionist movement works through systems of incentivization and compromising, in other words, blackmail. And there is not only one Epstein. There are probably thousands of Epsteins working globally. And I think the question has to be raised. All of these people, like Tony Blair, who was certainly one of the most prominent that was brought to power by the Zionist movement, to what extent is he compromised by the movement in some way? And I think, you know, investigations should be made into the potential for his compromisation in some way, but also what incentives are being offered to Blair other than power and status and influence and so on. And it's very clear from the Tony Blair Institute that now he's working very hard on embedding the GCC, Gulf Cooperative Council, so all of the Arab Gulf states, into the Zionist bloc. And I think that is one of his most important roles on behalf of the Zionist movement.
Yeah, indeed. But David, what about the role of Lord Levy in enlisting these kind of funders? I mean, our old friend Trevor Chin and Frank Lowy, for example.
Well, I mean, as I was saying about the about the role of Levy, he was Lord Cashpoint. He was the one who brought the finances. That Labour was not going to be critical of Israel. It was not going to challenge the wealth of the wealthy Jewish donors who were being tapped. And he was the one who brought all that to bear. And Chin, of course, is the most important of these in the sense that he's effectively and has been effectively since the 1970s the leader of the British Zionist movement. He's been at the head of the biggest Zionist charity, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, and it had previous names before that, since the 70s, or I think even further back than that, and he remains at the top of that organisation. So he is effectively the leader of the Zionist movement in the UK, and of course he has very strong links directly with the Zionist regime. And so you have the way in which this worked is that you have, there's sort of different strands of Zionist funding for the political parties. So Levy brings in the ones who are traditionally favourable to a kind of moderate left neoliberalism. There are others who are much more conservative. And then you have some who are willing to play bipartisan. So, for example, Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, who's a hard-line Likudnik, but who will nevertheless fund the Labour Party if it has advantage
right,
for it.
Right, yeah, indeed, of course. Well, Vanessa, I mean, what was Israel's role in pushing for war in Iraq then, do you think?
Oh, I think, I mean, that you have to look at the Clean Break doctrine in 1997, which was effectively a strategy paper written by CIA operatives, commissioned by Netanyahu. And this was all about the partitioning of the Middle East or West Asia region into sectarian statelets that would be easier to manage for Israel and also potentially more sympathetic towards Israel. So this was the early, if you like, Abraham Accords plan. And then the war against Iraq was incredibly important to basically install U.S. military bases in Iraq to threaten both Iran and Syria. And in fact, from the Clean Break doctrine and commentary on the doctrine itself, we know that the road to Damascus was through Baghdad. So it was very important for Israel for Iraq to be effectively destroyed as a functioning resistant state to the presence of the Zionist entity in the region, and to prepare for the war against Syria, and then, of course, the war against Iran.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. And David, briefly, because I think we're nearly out of time, I mean, the son of Lord Levy seems to be getting quite a lot of pro-Palestinian airtime on Qatari-funded platforms, doesn't he? Are you buying that?
Well, no, of course, this is Daniel Levy we're talking about, who used to work for the Israeli government.
Yeah.
And now poses as pro-Palestinian. And he, some of the things he says, if I was to say them, I would be accused of being anti-Semitic and all the kinds of things that you say. So he says some stuff which is quite sensible in some respects. But, of course, there's a limit to the sense that he will do. And it's a limit which is effectively sympathetic to Zionism in the end. And I saw Levy, I was in Doha last year, I think it was. So Levy there, having a cozy lunch with Ben Jamal, the head of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, another organization which is soft on Zionism. Yeah. And that's how this works. There's people who appear to be pro-Palestinian, like Al Jazeera, like Daniel Levy, like Ben Jamal, but actually they're effectively, covertly working for the Zionists.
But what's Levy's game then, do you think, then, in terms of trying to kind of portray himself as...
Well, the Zionists want to work both ends of all games. So when people say, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn couldn't possibly be a Zionist, look at all the pro-Palestine stuff he's done. Well, you see, well, actually, his position is a Zionist position, and the Zionists want to pressure from all sides, and that's why when the Zionists come for Jeremy Corbyn, people say, oh, he couldn't possibly be a Zionist. Well, the Zionists will play all sides of all games.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Vanessa Bealey, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Out of love, that on that day I'll be okay.
That's not the way it works. Help me find my way. My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong. I know I'm waiting, yearning for something, something known only to me. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
الانسان همانا انسان خلق الانسان من عجل آیه صحیحش اینه خلق الانسان من عجل.
In ayah 37 of surah al-anbiya in the holy Quran we read man is a creature of haste. However, in continuation of the same ayah we read, so do not ask me to hasten. Now, one might ask, isn't here in this verse a contradiction? From one side, human is created from haste, and from the other side, humans are asked not to hasten. The main question here is, how a human who is created out of haste must not hasten in his actions? The best answer to this doubt is that Allah has created humans with haste and many attributes like anger or sexual desire, so that He uses them in the positive way. For instance, if there was no haste, no one would try to overtake others in doing good deeds or helping others with their needs. Thus, haste, like any other thing, can be used in both positive and negative ways. It is like a knife with which one can peel the fruit skin or hurt others. Or it's like a hammer in the hands of a blacksmith who beats the iron to make something out of it. The very sense of haste is exactly like this. It is necessary for humans. However, haste has its own timing, and we are not allowed to hasten in all our efforts. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا أو you who believe استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That last inspiration that we want to take, inshallah, from the day of Ashura, I felt would be good to be that of death itself, and that everything is going to end, brothers and sisters. I want to share with you some hadiths, inshallah, as much as I can today, as many hadiths as I can that speak of this the importance of this death. The good thing about Ashura is that it really helps a person detach. You know, after they raised the head of Imam Hussein on the spears, you're just like, I don't really care too much right now about dunya. Yeah, it's one of the etiquettes that on the day of Ashura we don't work. Now some people think it's haram, whatever. If it's disrespectful to Ashura, it's haram. Other than that, it's very much, it's makruh to work. A believer doesn't need to be told not to work on such a day, unless they're forced to, of course. Why? Because you have this feeling in you that you don't care too much. Yeah? Now, after Ashura, a little bit passes and we go back to normal again, that's fine. Because the wound of Karbala isn't a fresh one, it's one of 1400 years ago. If we were back then, we probably couldn't eat or drink and we would probably die with that. As they say, some of the wives of Imam Hussein, that's what happened to them. They just couldn't live anymore. And they eventually died maybe a year or two after. So, yes, I was saying that this Ashura helps us come to terms with this, helps us to have a temporary but total detachment, okay, for all of us. And so with that, I want to remind that I chose this night for this topic. So let's go through some of these hadiths here about the remembrance of death. Imam Ali, salawatullahi wasalamu alayhi. ما أنزل الموت حق منزلته من عد غدا من أجله or ما أنزل الموت حق منزلته من عد غدا من أجله that a person has not given death its proper due and credit and has misunderstood death actually the one who considers and counts tomorrow as part of his life or her life. He says, if you count tomorrow as part of your life, like you're confident that there's a tomorrow for me, then you haven't understood death. That's how dangerous death is. Before you know it, you're gone. Ya Allah. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, مَا مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِ شَعْرٍ وَلَا وَبَرْ إِلَّا وَمَلَكُ الْمَوْتِ يَتَصَفَّحُهُمْ فِي كُلِّ يَوْمْ خَمْسْ مَرَّاتٍ There is not a family out there, he says, that except that the angel of death and comes and strokes their heads five times per day. Now is that the times of Salat? What time is it? Whatever. All in all, مَلَكُ الْمَوْتِ is our neighbor. He's our buddy. We don't even know it. He's there every day, stroking our heads five times, yeah? As if, hey, I'm waiting for you. One of these times when he strokes, with that stroke, will probably go our soul as well. And so here I am thinking that, yeah? I'm going to live forever. That's how beautiful Allah has done it, by the way. Allah has done it so beautifully. You know how? Allah didn't let us know when we're going to die. Everyone out there knows we're going to die. I don't see them spending billions of dollars on the cure for death. They do that for AIDS, cancer, COVID, things like that. But they don't do it for death. Why? Don't you think that we can reverse that? They know they can't reverse that one. That's one thing everyone agrees on. Okay? So, if this is something that everyone agrees on, everyone knows is happening, then Why is it that we feel like it's never going to happen? Because we don't know when it's going to happen. Like, Allah does it so beautifully. That's why we need these reminders. Because if we don't have these reminders, we actually will practically think that we're eternal. And the greats, they say, yes, we are eternal, but there's a bridge of death to that eternity. That's the part we kind of forget about. Prophet Isa was asked, who are the awliya'ullah, those chosen ones of Allah? Tell me, tell us something about those. How can we know that someone is a chosen one of Allah? What is one of their characteristics, at least? It says, أَحَبُّ ذِكْرَ الْمَوْتِ وَتَرَكُوا ذِكْرَ الْحَيَاتِ. One of the signs of those who are awliya'ullah is that they love the remembrance of death. And it doesn't say they hate, but they leave and abandon and put aside remembrance of dunya. I mean, when you're in the dunya, when you're in this life, do you need to remember it? You're here. Why? You remember something that is absent, right? That's not there yet. So why talk about it so much and remember it so much when we're already here anyway, number one. Number two, and we know it's going to end. Yeah? And so let's talk about that which is going to come and is never going to end. That's for them. And so, brothers and sisters, if you ever see me or anybody else either speaking in a way or living in a way or having a certain lifestyle in a way that the first thing or one of the first things that comes to your mind and catches your attention about them is the flashiness of dunya, yeah? The glitter and glamour of dunya, yeah? This is not a culture of Ahlul Bayt. Just remember that, please. Let's be a little picky and selective. أَحَبُّ ذِكْرَ الْمَوْتِ وَتَرَكُوا ذِكْرَ الْحَيَاتِ. All right, so these are some hadiths on the importance of the remembrance of death. But why? What does remembrance of death do for us? Well, it removes heedlessness, ghafla, forgetfulness. It removes all of that from us, as I said. Yeah, we were created for somewhere else. We forget.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper-thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's
not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too
greetings, dear listeners. I'm welcoming you to another meaningful hour here on Iran Radio. First, let's embark on another global journey with Round the World with Reporters. Our correspondents will bring you more fascinating reports on a variety of subjects from their regions, diverse stories from across the globe. Following that, we bring you The Keys of Life, hosted by Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musavi. This program aims to introduce the Islamic lifestyle based on the book Mafatihul Hayat, written by Ayatollah Javadi Amuli, Practical Guidance for a Purposeful Life. After The Keys of Life, we delve into viewpoints. Here, Brother Atta and Sayyid Ali Marashi will lead an analytical roundtable discussion of various religious, political, cultural, and social issues of the Islamic world today. In this program, we pay particular attention to mainstream news of the Islamic issues and Muslim lands. Coming up, it's time for more Round the World with Reporters. Don't go anywhere.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Foreign journalists walking through the ruins of residential neighborhoods, witnessing the human cost of war firsthand. Each destroyed home telling a story. Personal belongings buried beneath the rubble, lives forever changed, and families left shattered in the wake of Israeli missile strikes. One of the hardest hit areas on June 15th was Tehran's Tajrish Square,